not wanting to argue things that we, I think, have explained very well in our brief, there are just a couple of things that I believe were somewhat unclear that I would like to point out to the court.
And your name is, please?
Judith Carlson.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson.
The issue of bankruptcy weighed very heavily in this case, and there are a couple of things that I did want to point out about that. Judge Granger seems to be somewhat confused about the difference between a Chapter 11 and a Chapter 13. Bankruptcy attorneys explained what the difference was, that in 11 you pay off your debts over a period of time, and 13 they're discharged. And the trial court keeps talking about things being discharged as far as debts and how that would affect the property settlement. And even though the bankruptcy was speculative during his first opinion, during the second opinion, both counsel had informed him that the bankruptcy petition had been dismissed and was no longer an issue.
Ms. Carlson, on appeal, are you challenging both his failure to acknowledge the after the fact that the bankruptcy had been dismissed and his initial treatment of the bankruptcy issues before the bankruptcy was dismissed?
I think they're basically both the same thing, because the way that even if the bankruptcy had gone through, he was under a misapprehension as to what the effect would be. And then once it was clear that it wasn't going to go through and that it had been dismissed, he didn't alter his position anymore and still continued to assume that it was going to have some effect.
It seems from my reading of the order that after listening to the experts on the bankruptcy, that the court perceived the maintenance as being the area that was the easiest tool to use to avoid the unforeseen consequences of the pending bankruptcy proceeding. Would that be an accurate reading of what the court was doing with the maintenance or not?
I couldn't hear the last thing you said.
Well, I'm just saying that it looks like the court was viewing maintenance as the tool to deal with any unforeseen consequences of the then pending bankruptcy proceeding. And I was wondering if your view of what the court was doing with maintenance is consistent with that.
I think that it was somewhat due to that, because as I pointed out, and that was the second point I was going to make on the maintenance, that he ordered more than $10,000 more in maintenance than what she had said her reasonable needs were. And I think that that probably was related to him assuming the bankruptcy was going to go through and that there would be some consequence to her.
And so once the bankruptcy was dismissed, then did the court not adjust the maintenance, reduce the maintenance?
It reduced the maintenance by $3,000. $3,000.
And the time as well, too, from 7 to 5 years?
Yes.
Okay. And how is that not an appropriate response to the dismissal of the bankruptcy?
Because throughout the opinion, he keeps talking about the debts in relation to the bankruptcy and talking about just totally ignoring the tax problem, which is basically the main problem in this case, is the amount of taxes that were not paid and were owing. As far as the reason for the delay, which is brought up in the opinion, that it sort of subsumes that the delay was caused by Dr. Kornman. Actually, what happened, there was no way an 11 plan could be established until the maintenance and child support were established. And as soon as in the first opinion, in the December opinion, as soon as that was established, then Mr. Sender went into court and said, with this amount of maintenance, we cannot formulate a plan that can be paid off within the 5 to 7 years that the bankruptcy court would allow. And that's then the bankruptcy petition was dismissed. The second issue that I would like to address is the issue of maintenance. As I previously stated, the reasonable needs were established at, there's vague reference to Judge Granger saying that each of them had $15,000 worth of reasonable needs to meet their expenses every month. And then on her financial affidavit, all she was asking for was a little in excess of $18,000. And that included the expenses for the child. And ultimately what she was given in the second opinion was $28,500 a month, which was almost $10,000 more per month than what her reasonable needs were. When establishing the maintenance, the main thing that the trial court seemed to be focusing on was the standard of living established during the marriage. And the testimony from both parties was that prior to the year before they split up, that they paid their bills, they lived within their means, and they did not have a terribly high standard of living. The high standard of living came about after Dr. Korman announced that he wanted to divorce his wife. The standards for maintenance talk about the time necessary to get sufficient education. She didn't need that. She had the education. The testimony was that she could make between $80,000 and $100,000 a year working as a first assist operating room nurse. He specifically says that she doesn't have to work until after her maintenance runs out in 5 years. And she had already been getting maintenance for 2 years prior to that. So we're talking about 7 years altogether. Duration of the marriage was about 10 years altogether, from 8 years from the time they separated, but it was 2 years after that before the final orders. The age and physical and emotional condition of the spouse seeking maintenance, she was substantially younger than him, was in good health. There was no reason why she wouldn't be able to work.
Certainly the court could have done a different award of maintenance, but what about the scenario makes the award of maintenance that was actually given an abuse of discretion?
When there's evidence from Dr. Korman about how much money he actually brought in and how much he had to pay out every month, and the exhibit 596, his bills per month, if he includes the taxes, he includes the attorney's fees and the things that the court was going to make him pay, came up to $143,280 a month. His income was $56,716, and there was no way that he could possibly make those payments. The court just never dealt with the tax issue, which is the main bill that these people had, and in fact had made things worse by telling him not to pay the taxes during the 2 years that the divorce was pending. So no current taxes were paid. They were accumulating interest and penalties throughout the whole case, and it just kept compounding. The judge relied on Eric Six's analysis of the maintenance. Eric Six did not take into consideration any debts or the tax situation, and did not include the $2 million life insurance policy that the judge was ordering. And his income analysis was $100,000 less than what was actually there. And he did not include the personal credit card payments in what he was figuring out. And he also said that Dr. Carmen was a family of one, when actually at that time he still had a special needs child living with him, who's still living with him. And that leaves me 4 minutes left. So,
could I put a question to you, counsel, before you sit down? One of your issues on appeal is that the court erred in failing to apply the economic fault doctrine and find dissipation of marital assets. Was the court ever specifically asked to find that the wife had dissipated marital assets?
And we presented evidence of what it was that she had dissipated, and it came in excess of $700,000 during that 18-month period of time from the time he announced he wanted a divorce until he took over the finances.
Do you recall, don't look it up if you don't know off the top of your head, was this done by separate motion or was this part of
it was
this
the trial?
Part of it, okay. Thanks.
Please the court, Amy Loper, 10974 for the appellee Rose Corn. I'd like to focus primarily on three issues, if I may. The post-trial withdrawal of the bankruptcy, the award of attorney fees, and the exclusion of Gelfond. I'd like first to address bankruptcy. It cannot have escaped this court's notice that husband's basic arguments are in the disjunctive. One, the court ignored his inability to formulate a plan, thereby invalidating the amended permanent order as a matter of law, and two, that the amended permanent order assumed he would have the protections in bankruptcy, thereby invalidating the amended permanent order as a matter of law. Let us examine both prongs. Harvey Sender's testimony was given only in October of 2010. He never testified that husband could not formulate a plan. Indeed, his only testimony was given 2 months prior to the issuance of the permanent order. Whatever Harvey Sender may have told husband 2 months after the permanent order entered was never part of the record. There was never any testimony. Counsel's statements in a Rule 59 motion do not satisfy that as evidence. To accept husband's argument on this point, this court has to conclude, one, the trial court was obliged as a matter of law to find that the husband had been unable to formulate a plan, two, that the court's failure to do so invalidates the amended permanent order as a matter of law. As a matter of fact, the court found husband could pay his debts and his expenses with his allotted property and income, irrespective of actions he might take in bankruptcy. I've moved to the disjunctive prong, which is that the amended permanent order fails as a matter of law solely because husband withdrew his bankruptcy. That is the husband's contention. This is a misreading of the court's order taken as a whole. The court originally found that the mediated agreement was conscionable. The court expressed concern that enforcing that agreement would permit husband to thwart his orders. The court found that husband was willing to use bankruptcy to harm the wife financially. In the permanent order, the court in effect rearranged the deck chairs, gave wife more assets, more income, and assigned her debt. In the court's post trial order of February 4th, 2011, the court said, after receiving both of the 59 motions, the court has considered the dismissal of bankruptcy, and this caused the court to review the order and the evidence in the case. That is a quote from the court. The court actually said that structuring final orders around the speculation as to the result of future events was not going to be the basis of the amended permanent order. The court said that it would not speculate whether her husband would be in bankruptcy or would not be in bankruptcy. The court said it was entering an order substantially along the lines of the mediated agreement, and the court said if wife got injured along the way, which is one of the court's concerns, that she could return to the court for amended orders. There was no assumption in the court's opinion about whether husband would be in bankruptcy or would not be in bankruptcy, and the court never attempted to find that husband could better pay his debts if he was reorganizing in bankruptcy.
Counsel, doesn't the amended permanent orders say that respondent files for Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection?
The only evidence in this case concerned a Chapter 11. There was no evidence of a personal liquidation. That is a typographical error and nothing more, because the court doesn't go on to discuss pure liquidation. And all the testimony from both experts concerned an 11, which is a reorganization. And all the court's references are to a reorganization.
And did that testimony also concern the discharge of the debts as opposed to just restructuring?
The testimony concerning the discharge of the debts was that husband could discharge joint debts that he was awarded, thereby harming wife and forcing wife to pay discharge debts with no remedy of indemnification because they'd been discharged in bankruptcy. In that respect, the bankruptcy court had authority over the domestic court. That's what caused the domestic court concern in the initial permanent order. And the court ultimately determined that it just was not going to speculate about bankruptcy.
But doesn't the amended order also say that when the court is talking about its expressed intention that the bankruptcy not affect this amended order, the court said to recognize petitioner's property interests as unaffected by respondent's bankruptcy and to establish non-dischargeable obligations of respondent to petitioner under 11 U.S.C. 523.
It was the court's intention that its amended permanent order be carried out, irrespective of whether husband was in bankruptcy. The significance of the amended permanent order is that the court determined not to speculate what husband would or would not do in bankruptcy. The court did express its intent that its amended order be carried out regardless, but that was not something that was in the court's control.
So the husband here is saying that because the court misperceived that this was a 13 rather than 11, that this affected the court's other decisions, maybe including with regard to maintenance. What's your response to that?
If the court did misperceive the 13, which is not what the court did, a 13 and there was no evidence about a 13. Nobody testified concerning that. So this court would have to assume, you know, what is a 13? What does that mean? And if a 13 meant in a straight liquidation that the husband could discharge all debts that he was awarded and not have to structure a plan, that would render the court's initial speculation of that much greater concern, not a lesser concern. The real issue is that husband asserts that the withdrawal of the bankruptcy was a material fact which, standing alone, compelled the court as a matter of law not to enter the amended permanent order. And only the Scott versus Custer case is cited. Does the court wish me to review the facts of Scott? With respect to the attorney fee award, the guts of husband's argument is that the court order entered solely for the purpose of punishing husband and is not supported by the relevant economic facts. Those facts are the value of the estate and the findings concerning income. And the amended permanent order is very clear about the value of the estate awarded to each party, and the amended permanent order is very clear about findings of income. Under the amended permanent order, even considering the ultimate attorney fee award, the distribution of the estate, using the court's numbers, would be 48-52 in wife's favor, as opposed to the original distribution, 55-45, in the husband's favor. Similarly, the findings on income give the husband 73% of the gross income and wife 27% of the gross income. The court had already found that wife's attorney fees were reasonable and necessary. So regardless of husband's conduct, the court's attorney fee award is supportable under 119 in terms of the relevant economic facts. But husband asserts that the attorney fee order was made solely and exclusively to punish him, and this is not the sole basis of the court's order. Husband cites the Anthony Guiar case, and Anthony cites a case called Trout, which has some similarities to this case. In Trout, the court had already made findings regarding the party's respective finances. In that case, it was the wife against whom the fee order was entered. The court made finding about Mrs. Trout's resources. The court incorporated those findings into its decision, and like this case, the court in Trout found that Mrs. Trout had initiated circumstances which, in the court's word, should not have been had. The conclusions that the court reached are supported by law under relevant economic circumstances, and to the extent that there was a slight redistribution of property based on husband's conduct, that is not an abuse of discretion. Finally, I'd like to touch on the exclusion of the Gelfond report.
I'd like to ask you about the appropriate employment.
Okay.
The husband is addressing that wife could have made $80,000 to $100,000, and the court gave her a 5-year window in which she does not need to seek employment. As I recall, the court's order referenced, at least to some measure, the child. What's your position on their argument regarding appropriate employment?
Appropriate employment is tested under circumstances and standards of the standard of living and the expectations of the parties during the marriage. The court relied very heavily on the mediated agreement in which the parties had expressed their specific intent and specific agreement for $25,000 a month of maintenance, contractual, non-modifiable, for a period of 5 years. And the court relied on that agreement, and that particular point in the mediated agreement had never been challenged by the husband ever at any stage in the proceedings.
Excuse me, did the husband not at any time in the proceedings ask or make the argument that the wife was employable and should be required to seek?
Oh, no, the husband made that argument. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is the husband never challenged that he had agreed to that in June of 2009.
But in the end, is the court not required to, as part of the maintenance consideration under the statute, consider appropriate employment?
Yes, and the court did that. And the court specifically found, and Eric Six specifically testified, that even if you could set wife's earning capacity at $100,000 a year, and even if that was then included in her income, along with the maintenance that she was awarded, she would still have less income than the husband, substantially less income than the husband. So what the court did was be influenced by two primary factors. One is that the court did not expect the wife to work full-time to meet that potential because of the circumstances with the child. But the court acknowledged, and the testimony was undisputed, from Mr. Six, that even if wife earned $100,000 a year, the maintenance award could stand both in amount and in duration. And there is a specific finding on that point.
And you said the circumstances with the child, particular circumstances with the child?
The particular circumstances with the child were that the wife was essentially and virtually the sole caretaker of the child. The husband had very limited visitation, and it was wife's responsibility to do basically everything for this child. She was, in effect, raising the child alone, and the court so found. Those responsibilities were of sufficient magnitude that the court made reference and found that, in effect, working full-time, attempting to then get daycare for the child would be counterproductive, and that was one of the court's remarks.
And with regard to the comparison between husband's income and after the order, husband's income and wife's maintenance, what's the basis that you're arguing that those should be compared? I mean, wife's entitled to a certain amount of maintenance. She's entitled to a standard of living. But why does that have to be comparable to husband's income?
If the court looks at wife's reasonable needs, and these were basic needs of paying her mortgage, her utilities, and so forth, those, the court said, I am going to put these parties on parity with $15,000 a month for basic first mortgage, utilities, and so on and so forth. With a maintenance award of $25,000 per month, the wife then has a net after paying taxes of about $22,000 a month. And there were no frills in the basic budget. On the other hand, husband's income allowed him a significant amount, $45,000, $48,000 a month, after he paid current taxes and after he paid maintenance to meet his obligations. So part of the court's reasoning and part of an appropriate reasoning for maintenance is the party's relative economic circumstances. Not solely, wife has to live at the absolute bottom of her needs, the bottom, regardless of husband's circumstances. These were expectations that were established during the party's marriage, and they were expectations that were very clearly expressed by the parties in a mediated agreement that the court found enforceable and conscionable, but for the court's initial concern of how the bankruptcy would affect that and whether wife would be harmed by that.
Ms. Loper, but your argument suggests to me that that what you're saying is that maintenance is supposed to be fairly equivalent. Although we when we do property, we divide up the property in a fashion that's fairly equivalent. It sounds to me like you're saying even if wife's needs were only $22,000 a month, that if the husband had greater resources, that we must equalize their income and therefore give wife a maintenance award that equalizes. What's the basis for that?
But, Your Honor, I am not suggesting that the court found that it had to equalize the party's income.
But you're suggesting that the court should have.
No, respectfully, I'm not. What I am saying to the court is that when the when the court divided the incomes of these parties and looked at their gross incomes and their net incomes, it divided the gross incomes 73-27 in husband's favor, and it looked at their net incomes and it found that their net incomes were appropriate, did not inappropriately deprive wife of a standard of living that the parties had enjoyed during the marriage, but also did not deprive husband of that standard of living. And so the maintenance award was appropriate given that, but the court didn't make an effort to say, wife, you must have the same amount of income as husband, and indeed the maintenance award does not accomplish that.
I understand. Thank you. Bailiff, would you give Ms. Loper 1 minute to talk about the Gelfond issue?
The guts of the argument on Gelfond is that the court may never, under any circumstances, regardless of the expert's behavior, exclude testimony. But there is no dispute about the inherent power of the court. There's no dispute that Gelfond violated the rules. He violated the integrity of the process, and the court found that the magnitude and manner of those violations compromised his neutrality. In other words, the court didn't err in precluding husband from using Gelfond not to rebut Karsh, but solely to rebut Six on a methodology that Karsh had categorically rejected. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
A couple of points I would like to make. When we were talking about the $15,000 to $18,000 reasonable needs that Ms. Corman was alleging, these included $650 a month for vacations, belonging to four tennis and golf clubs. This was certainly not a basic expense kind of reasonable needs. As far as the maintenance issue also, and it
also comes into the taxes, that Judge Granger ordered that Dr. Corman could not claim the taxes on the maintenance, which was about $100,000 a year, because he said it was undifferentiated. But he says later in his opinion that it's always been $3,500 for child support, and I'm going to keep it at $3,500 for child support. This substantially increased Dr. Corman's taxes, and it had been several years that it had been accumulating then penalty and interest, and he had to file amended taxes on that. As far as the Chapter 11 and 13, there's no evidence that it was a typo. He keeps talking about the things being discharged, which is not what happens on an 11. And that was laid out in Harvey Sender and Mr. Weinman's explanations of the bankruptcy laws.
So how did that misperception affect the court's awards here?
The court keeps talking about I'm going to move stuff around so that it can't be discharged in bankruptcy, and if she has to pay the debts, this is going to make up for it. And it ended up that wasn't the situation at all, that Dr. Corman was given all of those debts ultimately and is responsible for all of them. As far as the mediated agreement was found to be unconscionable, and that issue was not appealed. The mediated agreement is still unconscionable at this point because that was the last ruling from the court. And the standard of living, as far as what Mrs. Corman had as her standard of living, there was no consideration given at all to what Dr. Corman's standard of living was going to be and who it was who made the money in the family, and also the issue of her not having to work. To say that someone who can make $100,000 a year, that wouldn't affect their maintenance, I mean, that's going to be at least $8,000 a month that she's going to get in that he wouldn't have to pay if she worked. And for her to say, you know, she's got a child who's in school full time and she can't work, there's certainly an awful lot of women who would take issue with that.
Thank you, counsel. Once again, I want to thank counsel for their well-prepared and cogent arguments.